The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific. And this week, because in Europe, the clocks go back a week earlier than they do in North America, thanks to the U.S. government's attempt to save fuel, it's 1 p.m. BST. Each week, with my global roster of guests, I talk about emerging and frontier market investing, and we try to clear up some of the confusion about these markets and why we feel they're a very attractive long-term play on the growing middle class in these countries. I spend most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to manage large amounts of investors' money. So I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments in countries and the ones that are perhaps not so promising. By emerging markets, we of course mean the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But it also includes a number of major economies such as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today we'll have a report on Russia to lead off the show. We'll also have a report on Colombia, which is counted as both a frontier and an emerging market by some index compilers. By frontier markets, we mean countries like Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today we'll have a report about the economic outlook for Nigeria, the largest and fastest growing economy in sub-Saharan Africa, outside South Africa. And we'll have a report from Dubai on the United Arab Emirates, which, while currently being ranked as a frontier market, is going to be upgraded to emerging market status next year. To get started today, I have independent Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from London. He says there are still some misconceptions about Russia that need clarification, some of which may be putting investors off from looking at a country which has many attractive opportunities. Welcome back to the program, James.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
So when we last spoke, you were in Monaco, now you're in London, and I believe in a few weeks' time you're going to be moving to Russia. That's on a full-time basis, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So I was living in Monaco for about 3 years, but I decided to move back to Moscow because I think there's a lot more opportunity there, and so I write down in transit between the two countries.
So that's obviously a fairly major vote of confidence on your part in terms of the outlook for Russia. You've suggested, I think, in our last conversation that Russia might have more going for it than most investors believe. Could you elaborate? Because obviously there are concerns about the political environment, about corruption, and we'll touch on those a little later in this conversation. But could you give us the sort of brief shorthand version of why you think Russia's attractive?
Absolutely. So I think one of the key points there really is that many people would say Russia is not actually an emerging market. It's more of a transition market because it was so well developed during the Soviet period. And so with that, you can see that there's a really exceptionally well-educated and large-scale workforce, very much in comparison with Western standards, on top of which it has a very low tax environment. And, of course, the fiscal situation is very attractive. Even today, Russia continues to run budget surpluses and, of course, has very large reserves. So economically, it looks much more stable and has great investment potential through the infrastructure and workforce.
So a number of attractive elements there and the low tax. Is it a flat rate tax system, I think, 18% or something like that?
In the individual, it's 13% flat rate, so yes,
13.
Flat and very low, which is obviously a key attraction when we look at what's going on with taxation in Europe here particularly.
Excellent. But on the other hand, would it be fair to say there are still real political risks and that while there may be have been some positive changes, some of which we discussed in the last conversation we had, it's still one of the things people need to consider when looking at Russia?
Yes, I think that the perception of political risk is really even bigger than the political risk itself. Certainly anybody who's investing in Russia will need to be asking themselves if the money will be expropriated, if the businesses will be safe, and if things will go to plan. And I think politically people are asking themselves what will happen after Putin finally does lose power. But I would also argue that these discussions are rather ignoring a lot of change that's already been going on. And so this week we saw that the World Bank has upgraded Russia from, I think, 119th to 90th in its ease of doing business rating scale. Russia is targeting to get to number 20 by the year 2018. That's obviously a very ambitious target, but even if they don't get there, they're firing high to sort of hit a very good target. This is leading to considerable improvements in the corruption situation and just the general ease and openness to doing business.
Well, that word corruption is obviously one that tends to come up whenever people talk about Russia and the difficulties of doing business or the ease of doing business there. You said that the risk of corruption is very low for new businesses. Are there specific reasons for that in terms of this attempt to make things easier, which you mentioned?
Sure. I think there's a couple of things there, really. One is that Russia is increasingly needing to attract investment in order to continue with economic growth. And a way to do that, it's really the government has begun to protect businesses from exposure to the corruption that has existed in the bureaucratic system for centuries, really. So there's really a sort of ring fence being put around new businesses. But also I think it's becoming clear that Putin himself is really going for his legacy now. So he wants to fight some of these big macro problems and make sure he leaves a stable environment when he does finally depart.
So with President Putin on side, and as you say, the need to attract new investment, that's certainly making it easier for new business. And obviously there is a large potential because, as you said, a well-educated, relatively high-earning workforce. And at the same time, people do tend to put Russia into the box of it's a resource economy. The reason you're there is oil and gas or other natural resources. What else is there outside of the natural resource sector, which tends to be fair to be where most of the more egregious examples of interference in business have taken place to attract investors or what that investors should be looking at?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it's certainly true that the resources sector, and there we can talk about metal companies as much as oil and gas companies, it's true that they continue to hold the limelight, as it were. They're by far the biggest and most liquid companies in the market. But Russia has a full economy, and the capacity to develop on almost every parameter. So there's plenty still going on in the retail sector, in the manufacturing sector is beginning to revive. The real estate sector is, of course, a massive area of development, and there is an increasing need for progress within the electricity generation area and distribution area. So really, it's really a very broad mix of opportunities. In many ways, because of this dependence on oil and gas, Russia hasn't developed to other areas very quickly, and so the potential is really still there.
Would you put telecom in that? In the list of areas that might be interesting as well, because certainly there are a couple of Russian mobile phone companies that have been quite expansive in terms of moving into areas outside Russia.
Mm-hmm. So the telecom sector, I have loved it for many, many years, and I've been an investor in it for many years. I'm not actively encouraging people at the moment simply because the prices are so high.
Okay.
And there is a sense of sort of saturation in the market, but the dividend yields are attractive, and so it's not something that you need to rush away from, but look for an opportunity to get into, really.
Right. Effectively, that's just a valuation issue. The actual sector, as you said, is very attractive, but lots of people have now recognized that. Going back to President Putin's position for the moment, of course, it's 100 days to Sochi Winter Olympics, which obviously is going to be a very high-profile event for the regime. Some analysts have suggested that perhaps, especially with the Moscow mayoral election, which we were talking about last time, President Putin's grip on power is maybe not as all-commanding as it appeared to be earlier in this decade. Would that be a correct analysis?
Yeah, that's a very tricky question in a way, in the sense that it's clear that Putin doesn't have the complete dictatorial power that a lot of the Western media and some analysts tend to ascribe to him. He doesn't have the ability to control everything that happens within the government or within the political system. So there are limitations on his power. But at the same time, it's also extremely clear that if you look among both the voting population and the political classes, there is no other single individual who commands so much respect, authority, and trust on such a broad level. And so from this perspective, he's by far the most powerful person, although, of course, not as powerful as this dictatorial perception tends to present.
So putting that all together, James, it sounds as though there are a number of attractive areas that investors should be looking at as far as Russia is concerned, that it's not merely a resource play, that while President Putin remains powerful in terms of looking after his legacy, he's intent on attracting new investment and also dealing with some of the legacy issues such as perceived corruption. All in all, would you feel that Russia should be on any emerging market investors list of major markets they should be looking at and including?
Absolutely. I think that at this stage you have a double benefit of the growing global economy, which is supporting those key oil and resources sectors. But also, as we've discussed, all of these other opportunities at the same time. Russia is always very exposed to the global economic cycle. So I think you can play it both from the local perspective and from the global perspective. And I would suggest that it's going to continue to show improvement over the next 12 to 24 months.
Excellent. Well, the best of luck on your forthcoming move to Moscow. And thank you also for that summary to indicate that people should not write Russia off when they're looking at emerging markets. And in fact, there may well be some very attractive opportunities, not merely confined to the resource sector.
Thanks very much to you, and good luck with the rest of the show.
Thanks so much, James. Our thanks to independent Russian analyst James Beadle on the line from London. When we talk to him again, he'll be based in Moscow, back there for the first time in 3 years, because he feels that the investment climate is improving sufficiently to make it attractive to be back on the ground. When I come back from the break, we'll be looking at the demographics of Colombia with regular contributor Peter Merrick and how they impact the country's status as an investment destination. Please stay with me for that.
Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We said repeatedly in our book that we just had published, Investing in Frontier Markets, and on this program, that demographics are one, if not the most important factor that will drive the growth of the markets we're discussing here. Colombia is viewed as an emerging frontier market. That is, it's on the cusp and is in both the emerging markets index and in some frontier markets indices. So it's a major market. It's been one of the best performing. And we've got our regular contributor, financial advisor and demographics expert, Peter Merrick, on the line from Toronto for a look at the country's demographics. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
Hi, Gavin. How are you doing today?
Very well, thanks. Now, you and I have talked about the demographic dividend when we've been discussing many of the countries we've talked about. But today, we're going to talk about the demographic transition model as well. Before you drill down on Colombia, could you explain that demographic transition model and how it differs from the demographic dividend that we talked about?
Well, it's the demographic dividend is part of the demographic transition model. So and when we look at a country and we're going to project how it's going to do and its people, we have to first look at the transition model. So I'd like to go over that first, and then we'll talk about how the demographic dividend fits in. The demographic transition model is broken into five stages. And the first stage is a society that has a high death rate and a high mortality rate. And a high birth rate. So basically the population stays pretty well the same because people are breeding and people are also dying. So the population stays stable. Stage two is where the mortality rate starts decreasing and the birth rate starts rising a bit. Where we see real growth happening in populations in the world is stage three. This is when mortality rates start dropping and birth rates remain the same, but the population grows substantially. And we've seen this with a lot of emerging markets over the last 50 years. The next stage that we move into is stage four, and that's where birth rates and death rates sort of equal out and populations stay the same. And then the fifth stage, we're starting to see in countries like Japan and Italy where the mortality rate is higher, where more people are dying than people who are being born. Now, looking at a demographic dividend and how that falls into place is when a country transitions from stage three, where they have a high birth rate and a lower mortality rate, where it starts equalizing, where the mortality rate and the birth rate sort of level off. And that's where the demographic dividend can really kick in, Gavin. And I'd like to share with you what the demographic dividend is.
Please
do. And then we can look at specifically how it relates to Colombia. A demographic dividend kicks in stage four, where the birth rate and the mortality rate sort of level off. And this is where you have lower birth rates. So yep. You're releasing more women to go into the workforce. You're also able to invest more into each child, because they have a survival rate, and plus there's more money in the society to invest in those individual children. You also have health care, education. In addition to that, you have rule of law.
Yep.
And then you also have a country that is outward focused, where they're looking at international trade. And what's occurred with Colombia over the last decade is it's starting to transition into level four of the transition model, and it is set to do really well under the demographic dividend.
That's very encouraging news, obviously, for people looking at Colombia. And would you say that that perhaps has contributed to the strong growth of the Colombian economy over the last 10 to 15 years?
I would definitely say that they've gotten their house in order. Back in the 80s and 90s, there was, you know, a lot of chaos. A lot of people left Colombia. The 5 million people over the years have left Colombia. But Colombia is a very large country in population. It's the third largest country in Latin America after Brazil and Mexico. It's got 46 million people. So it's got demographically, it's perfectly seated. It's calmed down politically. And it's got very few old people and a lot of people entering the workforce, and they're literate and they're able to read.
all of which is excellent news. The actual demographic structure of Colombia now, in terms of how many people are in the working age population, effectively they're in their sweet spot, as you say, they're in stage four, where both birth and death rates have stabilized, but you have a lot of people, a lot of young, productive people in the workforce. Would that be correct?
Yes. Well, when we look at the entire population, we should look at it in under age 14, 26% is under the age of 14. So they're not contributing as of yet. Only 6.5% are over the age of 65. So we've got a huge amount, 69 people who are able to contribute into the workforce. And they have a very strong domestic economy. Most of what happens in Colombia is being generated within. Most people don't also realize that Colombia has become a very urban country.
Right.
Most people actually live in the urban centers. And again, that's where industry is created. That is where trade is created. It happens in the urban centers. And Colombia is ready. Now, Colombia, I would actually say, I would compare Colombia to Brazil about 20 years ago. It's just a country that's getting ready to enter the international stage.
So, given that, as you said, it's an outward-looking economy. It didn't seem that from the people the experts we were talking to in Colombia, that there was much of an impact from the U.S. budget crisis and the end of tapering, or the possible end of tapering by the Federal Reserve. But there, as you said, given its large population, there still is a very large domestic economy, which is somewhat insulated from these outside impacts. Would that be correct?
Well, we have to look at where, you know, where their GDP is going. About 61% is going towards household consumption. And what does that really mean? Well, we've got, you know, families are becoming more affluent. We've got a growing middle class. Their economy is $500 billion as of last year. So it's, you know, it's a sizable economy. You know, and 61% is household consumption. These people, as they become more affluent, as a society joins the world economy, people want toasters, they want microwaves, they want all these things that in the developed world people already have. And one thing that people who look at demographics have realized a number of years ago is when you have an individual reaches over 48 years old, usually there's a transition amongst the individual. Their values change, and they're less into consumption and more into saving. Now, if you look at the demographics of Colombia, it's a population that is now, you know, the young people are becoming, joining the workforce, and they're starting to accumulate and start things in their lives, and that's what's driving the economy. They don't have to be so outward-focused in finding other markets. They have a young market that's becoming more affluent, and as that happens, you're going to see internal growth. And that's something which makes it demographically a very appealing country.
So, Peter, are there any other Latin American countries with a similar demographic profile to Colombia? Because obviously what you've described is a market that looks pretty attractive because it's fairly sizable domestic market with people becoming wealthier and therefore growth in those things like household goods and autos and finance and telecoms, all the things that you see in emerging markets. Are there any other countries within Latin America, apart obviously from Brazil, as the major country that's perhaps, as you said, or 20 years or so ahead of Colombia, but any other countries that fall into that same category?
Well, as we mentioned, Brazil in the past, and I would also look at Mexico. And Mexico is a perfect example. Many people in the West, investors, looked at Mexico as not being such a great place. But demographically, it's actually moved into stage four, where it's got a very young population, very few resources are going to service social security and all these benefits that these aging countries have, such as in Northern Europe, which are very costly. So I would compare it to Mexico. The only difference between, let's say, Mexico and Colombia is geographic. And what I mean by that is if you look at you know, where Mexico is situated, a lot of U.S. companies have actually moved there. That being said, Colombia in the last few years has signed a number of free trade agreements.
Yep.
So it's been very, very focused. It wants to trade, and it's got a very educated population. And as around the world, companies are not just going to look for cheap labor, or they're going to be looking also at the education of the people and also the youth of the country, because it's a lot cheaper to have a younger workforce than it is to have an older workforce. And Colombia becomes very attractive. Now, when we were talking about the demographic dividend, as soon as a country transitions from level 3 to level 4, and level 3, I just want to repeat, is where you have really high birth rates and you have lower mortality rates. When you switch over to level 4, where you've got the mortality rate is leveled off at the birth rate, you've got about a 30 to 50-year time horizon where the economy is going to really do well and exceed. And I'll use an example of a country in the West that has really benefited from the demographic dividend and is going to go through another transition in the next few years, and that happens to be Canada.
Right.
Canada had one of the highest birth rates after World War II. It was actually, at one point, it was higher than the United States, I guess because it was cold. Gavin, you're laughing because you lived here for a few years.
Yep. But so, as you say, just to finish off in the next minute or so, Peter, on that point on Canada.
Well, Canada had a huge birth rate, and in 1972, Canadians stopped replacing themselves. They moved from level 4 to level 5, and if they didn't have immigration, there'd be some major issues. But what's happened is Canada has fared really well since the economic turmoil since the early 2000s. It's because it's had the most productive workforce. What's happening now after this 40-year transition that Canada has benefited from, Canada has promised all these social benefits. Everything was promised to Canada when it was young, similar as it was in Colombia now. And Canada has benefited. Now Canada is transitioning, and the question is, will Canada and most of Western Europe and the United States be able to support all these promises that they made to a young population as they transition to becoming an older population and need these benefits?
No,
Colombia, for that reason, is a place I would look at, and I would say, let's project it 40 years forward, and it's got an incredible workforce for the next 40 years.
Well, thanks very much, Peter, for that insightful description of Colombia and also some thoughts on aging Western economies like Canada. Have you back to talk about another country soon.
Thank you so much.
Cheers. When I come back for the break, we're going to continue the Colombian theme by going directly to Medellin, Colombia, for a look at a Colombian stock that may end up in your funds in the not-too-distant future, because the largest Colombian airline, Avianca, is looking at, or has recently become, an American depository receipt. Rupert Stebbings from Valores Bancolombia, my apologies, will be on the line to tell us what that means. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750. You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Before the break, we were hearing from financial advisor and demographics researcher Peter Merrick about the demographics of Colombia. In this segment, we're actually going to drill down a little further to look at developments with a major stock in the Colombian market that may end up in some North American portfolios. For that, we have Rupert Stebbings on the line from Medellin, Colombia. He's Vice President, Equities and Research, Valores Bancolombia. Welcome back to the program, Rupert. Good morning. So Avianca Airlines, which is a major stock on the Colombian exchange, but is going to be listed as an American depository receipt, which essentially is a certificate representing an interest in the underlying stock. But what in essence does this move mean for Avianca in terms of credibility and profile?
I think with any emerging market stock, if you have yourself listed in New York and they're visible at a level 3 level radar, it's obviously going to help. Just the history in very short is that Avianca listed here a couple of years ago. It sold almost exclusively to retail clients, and now what they really lack is funds within the stock. And obviously the concept here is to get themselves listed in the US, sell themselves to funds, and if funds are invested in the stock, then obviously Wall Street analysts will cover the stock, and most of them will find a price target fair way above where it is right now. So it's to add liquidity and profile.
And I understand that Avianca, which is the largest Colombian airline, I'm correct in stating, had a roadshow in New York to promote the ADR issue. Is that really to, you said it's to raise its profile. Are they going to raise any funds from this? And if so, is it particularly important that they do, or is it much more the fact that you've got North American accounting and you're listed on some level of a North American exchange?
Yeah, I literally bumped into them coming out of an office in New York last week. They're just literally starting on a couple of weeks of roadshow. They're looking for something over $200 million to raise, which is important, but it's within a company that's looking for billions of dollars in new airlines and new airliners. It's not significant in terms of what they need, but it's significant serious profile and, you know, getting themselves in front of U.S. investors and funds in particular. And the stock has plenty of upside. So I think the roadshow will go well, and I think the issuance will go well.
And the stock has plenty of upside. It's an airline stock, haha. But primarily, again, because of the growth of air travel by the emerging Latin American middle class. I mean, we've seen stocks like LATAM Airlines, the merger between LAN and TAM, and Copa from Panama doing pretty well. Maybe LATAM, not so much. But that is a reflection of many more people being able to fly, correct?
Yeah, I mean, airlines, investors love them or they hate them. There's no in between. Avianca is basically the youngest fleet in Latin America, and it gets ever younger. They absolutely dominate the local market, and they're growing very quickly overseas. We see a lot of growth prospect, a lot of new airliners coming on stream, which have a lot cheaper in terms of costs due to the new efficiencies you're seeing in the airline. And for us, this thing has around, over the next 12 months, we see about a 25% upside to our price target. So, you know, there's a lot of airlines around. You love them, you hate them, but this airline is very young. It was purchased in 2004 for $80 million by Abramovich, and now is worth well over $1 billion. It's been a real turnaround story.
Excellent. There are some other Colombian stocks that already have ADRs, one of them being Bancolombia. Does a recent Moody's report on the Colombian banking industry, I understand, which is fairly favorable in terms of outlook? If you could just briefly fill our listeners in on that.
Yeah, I'll give you a potted history. Colombian banks basically went close to bankrupt in 1999 and 2000. stop lending. Had a terrible, terrible crisis here in non-performing loans. And then they turned the whole thing around. So banks now loan very little money overseas and receive very little money from overseas. They have very low non-performing loans. They're very efficient. And during the 2008, the worst of the crisis, the banks here were hardly touched. So the bank the banking sector here is rock solid. It's very tightly run. There's a lot of complaints here, obviously, that it's too tightly run, but they lend really to the people who can't pay them back. So the banking sector here has been very solid over the last 4 or 5 years, ever since the crisis first broke in 2008 on a global basis. So Moody's comments don't surprise me in the least.
No, well, it's always helpful for banks to lend to people who pay them back. Generally, that seems to be a good idea. Anyway, Rupert, thanks very much indeed for that update on Avianca. Interesting, the ADR issue, as you say, it's much more about profile than it is about raising cash. Hope to speak to you again soon.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Thanks. Thanks to Rupert Stebbings on the line from Medellin, Colombia, from Valores Bancolombia, for that look at Avianca Airline, directly as an ADR or perhaps in a mutual fund. But as he mentioned, Latin American Airlines are flying high at the moment. Our next report takes us across the world to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, where regular contributor Mark Townsend is on the line for a report on the surging real estate situation in Dubai. Mark was a major contributor to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets, and has been covering the Middle East for many years. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Good to be with you, Gavin.
Thanks. So, major real estate agent consultancy, Jones Lang LaSalle, recently released its third quarter report on the United Arab Emirates and Dubai in particular. Could you tell us the highlights of that?
Absolutely, Gavin. Well, you know, Dubai continues to increase its population here in parallel with a strong recovery in the economy, which is broadly based. The population's increased from 2 million in 2011 to 2.2 million by the first half of this year. And really, Dubai is continuing to benefit from a safe haven status, which is a direct result of the Arab Spring. So it's looking good here, Gavin.
And the Dubai economy itself, did we have some numbers for 2012 specifically? And what was driving the growth, which I understand was fairly strong?
Indeed. I mean, GDP grew by 4.4% last year. This year it's targeted to come in, I think, a little bit below that. But what's interesting since the 2008 crisis, Gavin, is that, you know, Dubai has got back to its fundamentals, its basics. And the GDP was strongly driven by the key sectors of hospitality, manufacturing, transportation, storage and communications, which are segments which Dubai does so very well.
Yes, it was perhaps somewhat overly focused on the real estate side ahead of the financial crisis in 2008-09. Is there some sign of recovery from what was a fairly severe bust, which led to a moratorium on debt payments by some Dubai entities? Are we seeing go ahead.
As you can probably recall, Gavin, the 2008 financial crisis in Dubai was the message was rippled across the world very, very quickly indeed, and brought a lot of financial markets almost to their knees. But since then, there's been significant restructuring, and all of the real estate sectors, I think, are improving. Office, residential, retail, hotel, and industrial, they're all in a recovery mode. I think the main thing to note is that the regulatory aspects, which have tightened quite considerably. Real estate transactions are up 63% year on year in the first quarter of this year. So it's a strong bounce back.
And MasterCard has also been looking at the Dubai economy, especially the tourism sector. What do they have to say?
Well, they say certainly tourism is a key aspect of the economy, and MasterCard is projecting that Dubai will attract close to 10 million visitors in 2013. 9.89 is the figure that they've calculated. And that by 2017, Dubai will be one of the top three travel destinations, surpassing Singapore, New York, and Paris, which
wow.
is certainly a bold prediction. But, riding on the back of that, of course, is the pending announcement, which is imminent now for the Expo in 2020. So a lot of hopes are, on the back of that. If it does succeed and it does win the bid, there will be certainly a massive amount of infrastructure spending, which all the other sectors will benefit too.
Yes, and then, of course, there's the Soccer World Cup in just down the Gulf in Qatar in 2022, which should hopefully also lead to some knock-on effects in terms of visitors. But evidently, it looks like confidence in the real estate sector is returned. Are we seeing that in things like rental rates? Is there some firming there as well?
Certainly, and I think, you know, as we'll come to, there's some qualification in terms of the, you know, the sort of health of the respective sectors. But in residential, office, retail, industrial, renters are becoming more economical in their use of space, and at the same time, landlords are becoming firmer in rents. I've witnessed that from my own experience, you know, a significant increase in my own apartment rent. By and large, the supply and demand of office space are generally running in tandem. Although I think, you know, there's some qualitative issues there, but the demand for new office stock roughly approximates to the increased office space becoming available. And, you know, there are some residential developers which are, you know, holding and hesitating to proceed. So, you know, we've got to watch the situation very carefully.
So to summarize then, while there's something of a recovery, would there be any danger of a recurrence of the crash of 2008-09 in terms of irrational exuberance getting out of hand, or is it just one particular area where there might be some weakness?
Well, one would hope not, because the crash of 2008 and that ensued across, you know, the residential, retail and commercial sector was very damaging. And I think the difference this time, which I'm prepared to sort of err on the side of to say that it won't be anywhere near as dramatic. But there's a key statistic that Jones Lang LaSalle did cite in their report, saying that house prices rose about 17.9, just under 18% in the year to end August, whereas the population and income growth increased only 5%. So you can see a very strong disparity there between the rise in house prices and income growth. Nevertheless, the government has taken some quite, you know, major steps in the regulatory area. It's doubled the registration fees to cool the market speculation. Just in the last 24 hours, there's been mortgage caps announced, which you'll be able to get a mortgage depending on whether it's your first house and the value of the house, a mortgage between 60 and 80% at the very maximum. So those aspects and some regulatory moves with developers that will have to put cash up front, which will stop the price flipping with the speculators so indulged in prior to the 2008 crash, Gavin.
Okay, Mark. Well, thanks very much for that excellent summary of the real estate market. And we look forward to speaking to you again in the not-too-distant future.
My pleasure, Gavin. Thank you.
That was financial journalist Mark Townsend on the line from Dubai with that look about whether history might be repeating itself as far as real estate is concerned. He believes not. And thanks again to him for his help with our book, Investing in Frontier Markets. When I come back from the break, I'll be on the line to Lagos, Nigeria, and our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, for a look at Nigeria's economic future. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus drug discount card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. So far today, we've been to London, Toronto, Colombia, and Dubai, and we're going to finish up by checking in with our African correspondent, Samuel Okoja, on the line from Lagos, Nigeria. Welcome back, Samuel.
Thank you so very much, Gavin.
Not at all. Now, for the past few years, we've been hearing analysts talk about the growth potential and therefore the investment potential of Africa, and particularly its largest market, Nigeria. But obviously, there are some challenges before we get to the good news. So could we look at the challenges in two sections? First, the oil industry, and then after we've looked at that, the infrastructure.
Okay, yes, that's true. The challenges in the oil industry remain. Security is an issue, especially piracy in the Gulf of Guinea. That's just off the coast of Nigeria. Well, piracy off the coast of Nigeria has had this year with gangs eyeing off lucrative oil cargo. The kidnapping of foreigners working in the oil sector was once a common occurrence in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. But abductions declined dramatically after a 2009 amnesty with rebels in the region. But they've spiked again in recent months. Just last week, pirates kidnapped two Americans from a ship off the Nigerian coast. As the number of attacks apparently seems to rise. So security, piracy to be precise, is still a major challenge.
And then as far as infrastructure is concerned, there's continuing problems with reliable power supply. Is there anything being done to address that?
Absolutely. There is a power reform going on right now. And it is opening investments for the private sector to participate in Nigeria's power sector. Specifically, General Electric, for example, has invested $1 billion in Nigeria's power sector. And so we do expect that in the next couple of years, we should see a stable power supply in Nigeria. And so that should help to solve infrastructure with regard to power.
Well, that would certainly help. Especially as the demographics of Nigeria look very promising, with a young and rapidly growing population, which helps deliver the demographic dividend we were talking about earlier in the program. Without going into too much detail, how would you describe Nigeria's demographics? Is there a fairly large middle class, for example?
Absolutely. Well, with the population of over 160 million, the interesting with Nigeria is that one, we have a very young population, and also we have a growing middle class, which means huge opportunities for business in consumer markets like financial services, food, energy, and telecommunications. And recent events has lent credit to the fact that Nigeria indeed do have a growing middle class. For example, we keep seeing investment in telecoms. We see telecoms companies, you know, bringing out products targeted at Nigeria's growing middle class. The same thing in the area of financial services. We are talking about mobile money. Companies are beginning to look at ways to tap into Nigeria's huge unbanked population. You know, so for me, the Nigerian demographic, the demography in Nigeria is an interesting one. We have a growing middle class, which investors are really trying to take advantage and tap into.
And indeed, that's so a very large domestic market. And at the same time, there's fairly high unmet demand for a number of services. You mentioned telecoms, but I presume also consumer goods or automobiles might also fall into that category as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. The domestic market is indeed huge, and that's why we've been seeing expansion in consumer companies. For example, ShopRite, which is Africa's biggest grocery store, has unveiled an ambitious plan to build 44 outlets in the next 3 to 4 years in Nigeria. Well, it might interest you to know that profits from Nigeria has exceeded that in South Africa. And this is because there is this unmet demand for, you know, consumer goods. That is why right now there is an expansion within ShopRite. We're also seeing similar moves by other companies, which I wouldn't want to go into. No. But the fact remains that there is an unmet demand because of the huge population and because of the growing middle class.
So we have oil, we have the huge domestic demand. Are there any other natural resource sectors where maybe there might be opportunities for Nigeria and which haven't really been exploited or fully developed yet?
Yes, absolutely. Nigeria makes most of its money from oil exports. However, it might interest you to know that we have over 9,000 natural resources that are yet to be tapped by the manufacturing sector as raw materials for finished products, for example. It might interest you to know that we have resources in natural gas. Yep. And this is hugely untapped. We have tin, we have iron ore, we have coal, we have limestone, we have lead, zinc, and of course, arable land, huge expanse of land that could boost food security, not just within Nigeria, but in the whole of Africa.
So to summarize then, Samuel, Nigeria has been one of the fastest growing economies in the world over the last decade. I believe it's one of the top 10 fastest growing economies in the world, along with another half dozen African countries. The growth of the middle class has been one of those drivers. Has oil actually contributed much to that, or has it been relatively steady in terms of output? So most of this growth is coming from the domestic side.
Yes, oil has actually been a major part of the growth in Nigeria. But interestingly, we're beginning to see other sectors, especially agriculture, contribute to the growth of the Nigerian economy. Although the Nigerian economy is heavily dependent on revenues from oil and gas, our government is committed to diversifying the nation's economy and reducing dependence on crude oil exports. Focus in recent times has been on increasing non-oil exports and reviving the agricultural sector. And of course, action is also being taken to improve Nigeria's notoriously poor infrastructure. The ongoing power sector reforms, for instance, which I mentioned earlier, should lead to significant improvements in power supply in the coming years. And so I want to believe one of the reasons why we are one of the fastest growing economies in the world is because of the activities in the non-oil sector of Nigeria. And so for those considering to invest in Nigeria, the message is that the opportunities far outweigh the risks.
Okay, Samuel. Well, thanks very much indeed. It's a very important point to remember, and we will be back to talk to you again about other opportunities within both Nigeria and the broader African economic scene in the not too distant future.
Thank you so very much. I do appreciate you having me.
Thank you. That was our African correspondent Samuel Okoja on the line from Lagos, Nigeria, for a look at some of the reasons why Nigeria has been amongst the fastest growing countries in the world over the last decade. People tend to regard sub-Saharan Africa as maybe a risky investment, and certainly there are issues in Nigeria with oil output, violence and corruption, of course. But at the same time, the opportunities are very great, and it's interesting that Samuel picked on both the domestic consumption side and also agriculture as two areas it might be worth looking at. That wraps up today's edition of Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. Please join me again next week. Some of the reports we're working on include an update on Brazil with Bill Hinchberger, who's covered the country for many years, now teaches about Brazil at the Sorbonne in Paris. We'll also be talking to Thomson Reuters financial correspondent Dasha Afanasyeva in Istanbul. I hope I got that right, Dasha, for a look at some Turkish financial stocks. And Rich Hula will return with an analysis of what the possible confirmation of Janet Yellen as head of the Federal Reserve in Washington in January could mean for emerging and frontier markets. So I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emed. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, now available in English-speaking markets around the world, primarily through such wonderful bookstores as Amazon.com. And we are working on Frontier Markets for Dummies, which is set for release next spring. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.com. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. The first issue is due out soon. We're excited about it. This program, the two books, and the newsletter demonstrate our commitment to providing up-to-date information on emerging and frontier markets to investors who are interested in looking at these. Thanks, and please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.